Penguin Random House Audio presents Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. This is the author, Daniel Stone. For my grandparents, and theirs too, who took ships overseas so that I can fly across them. Marine salvage, a science of vague assumptions based on debatable figures taken from inconclusive experiments and performed with instruments of problematic accuracy by persons of doubtful reliability and questionable mentality. Captain Charles A. Bartholomew, U.S. Navy. Author's note. If I asked you to guess, a shot in the dark, how many shipwrecks sit at the bottom of the oceans as relics of accidents past, what would you say? I have some advantage in asking this question because for several years I have asked almost everyone I've met, all of human history, all of Earth's water, how many shipwrecks? Guesses range widely from very tiny to very big, but what they all have in common is that they are all too small. They are most underestimated by kids, who can't be blamed. Their education of early human sea travel begins with the relatively recent eras of Magellan, the Spanish Armada, the Niña and the Pinta, and the still-missing Santa Maria. Maybe they've heard of the Titanic, but likely through the lens of Leonardo DiCaprio, or, more likely, Celine Dion. Adults are wrong too, but they're wrong by less. Most adults think of ships in the modern sense, such as the USS Arizona they saw in Pearl Harbor while on vacation, or the Costa Concordia from the news a few years ago. Looking backward, our historic understanding of ships clings to a few historical nuclei: Captain Cook, Columbus, the Maine, Ernest Shackleton, the Lusitania, or, again, the Titanic. Maybe a 250,000 was the highest estimate I ever heard, from a friend who's a U.S. Marine and the kind of guy who spends a lot of time in naval museums. It wasn't a bad guess, but when you account for all of human history and our planet's mostly aquiferous surface, the number is substantially higher. According to a UNESCO estimate, the number of ships that sit in underwater graves, wasting away year after year, is an incredible 3 million. When the Titanic sank in 1912, it plunged an astounding 2.5 miles and hit the seafloor at more than 30 miles per hour. Its ocean grave was so remote that its location remained a mystery until 1985, when a team that had the benefit of government-developed submarines and deep-water crafts was able to take some blurry snapshots. It took 73 years, almost an entire human lifespan, to find the most illustrious and fascinating shipwreck of all time. This is the story of what happened after the night the ship sank, how the Titanic changed the world, and how the world longed desperately to piece it back together. Shipwrecks have a habit of attracting colorful and unusual characters. Those characters tend to be overwhelmingly male and most often white, a reflection of a historically macho industry that runs on expensive machinery and huge sums of money. Many will tell you that they work in the most punishing environment on Earth, true, and also that working in the deep sea is harder than working on Mars. Possibly true. Yet just as many are armchair enthusiasts, amateurs, and white belts whose sole credential is their obsession. They get drawn into races, fights, and elaborate lawsuits. The odd quirk that ships are typically female is a holdover from times when vessels and their wrecks could, and still can, stand in as full-blooded companions. In the process of writing, I interviewed dozens of historians, salvage professionals, wreck experts, and lawyers, people who earn their livelihoods drilling for oil, hunting for treasure, investigating accidents, and filming documentaries. There's a common characteristic I noticed they share, perhaps best described as a polite but profound impatience for your crap. They have work to do, and they've seen more otherworldly stuff than you ever will. They're usually under pressure from rich investors and impatient scientists, and they carry an enormous amount of risk managing equipment, timelines, and people's lives. But every single one will eventually soften up and readily dish about the granddaddy of them all. In cultural lore, the Titanic is the wreck around which all others orbit. The same way a pop musician can't escape the influence of the Beatles or Michael Jackson, shipwreckers can't bypass the brightest star. In scientific terms, the Titanic embodies the waves of technological growth, failure, and advancement during its lifespan above water, and relentless obsession and elaborate deep-sea engineering below. This is not, in the words of Walter Lord, who wrote A Night to Remember, the seminal volume on the Titanic's final night, another book about the Titanic. This is a look at our oceans and the junk we've left in them. It's a yarn about the oddballs and misfits who devote their lives to wayward ships. And it is a deep dive into the waters of our planet and what lurks, in every sense, just below the surface. Daniel Stone, Santa Barbara, California, April 2021. Prologue. When snow falls, the properties of water perform a delicate dance. Snowflakes fall like dominoes fall. A piece of dust forms a crystal, and the appearance of that crystal attracts more crystals until they form long dendrites around the speck of dust like ants around a piece of chocolate. As long as the growing snowflake remains lighter than air, it will float. But as soon as one extra crystal crosses the tipping point, the structure will succumb to gravity and fall. Snow tends to fall in places where other snow has already fallen. And even though every snowflake is different, they're not as unique as we've been told. They start as spheres and form tendrils to diffuse heat. Cold temperatures produce flakes that look like bullets or needles. Extra cold weather is when you find the classic shape of a six-sided prism, or the fern-like crystal with six radiating branches. For some reason, there are always six. It was probably this form of fern-like snow that fell one day, 15,000 years ago, on the frozen ice sheets of Greenland. The landmass was already covered in ice 2 miles thick. With time, the fresh flakes descended into the ice, hidden from daylight and compressed by pressure to a third of their original size. Fitting with geology, thousands of years passed and nothing happened. Snow that started as flakes was transformed to dense glacial ice as it moved quickly, about 4 miles per year, toward the west coast of Greenland. Ice weakens as it nears the coast, because every day, particularly in the summer, enormous walls of ice flake off the glacier and fall into the ocean. This is how ocean icebergs form. But it was one particular iceberg that fell in the summer of 1909 that would drift toward infamy. Around too briefly to have a name, this iceberg was more than 2 miles wide and 100 feet tall at its birth, big enough to dwarf the Colosseum in Rome and all the pyramids put together, at least before it started melting. It would tower over the largest steamship ever conceived, which was also formed in that summer of 1909. At the time, humans knew little about the behavior of icebergs, except that most melted somewhere in the Arctic Circle. John Thomas Towson, a scientist devoted to ship navigation, who wrote a book called Practical Information on the Deviation of the Compass, observed in 1857 that icebergs were no different and no softer than rocks formed over millennia by time and pressure. Towson knew that icebergs posed an existential danger to the wooden hulls of 19th century ships. Steel hulls were invincible, he said, but that was based on assumption, not experience. Such an extreme number of icebergs traveled south through the East Strait of the Grand Banks in eastern Newfoundland that in 1912, the U.S. Coast Guard nicknamed the area Iceberg Alley. For 3 years, the icy mass bobbed and weaved in Arctic waters. At one point, it traveled north and spent the summer of 1910 farther toward the North Pole. Then it caught the Labrador Current, which carries freezing water south. Most icebergs melt within their first year. A few last two. Only a handful last three because, eventually, the Labrador Current meets the warm waters of the Gulf Stream, which acts as an oceanic microwave. Only 1% of northern hemisphere icebergs survive this desert zone. And finally, only one in several thousand would make it to 41 degrees north, the same latitude as New York City and directly in the path of transatlantic ships. Icebergs had struck ships as long as there had been ships to strike. But few icebergs had been as lucky as the one that fell the largest passenger liner ever built, particularly because on April 14, 1912, that iceberg was nearly gone. After 3 years adrift, the icy mass likely had 1 week to live, two at most. As icebergs melt from the bottom, they grow top-heavy and flip, followed by more erosion and more flipping until eventually, When they've been reduced to the size of a basketball, they're constantly flipping.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?